From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And for the second time in 2 months, the Donald Trump campaign has seen a shakeup. This morning, Stephen Bannon, the former banker who runs Breitbart News, was named campaign CEO. Kellyanne Conway, a Republican pollster, was named campaign manager. Paul Manafort keeps his title as campaign chair, but Bannon and Conway's positions are higher than his. Joining us now, NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Good afternoon.
And start with Bannon and Conway. What more can you tell us about them and what it means?
Well, what was fascinating to me about Bannon being announced in this press release that the Trump campaign put out, you know, Trump touted the fact that he was once called the most dangerous political operative in the country as that being a good thing to manage his campaign. So you know that he's moving in a direction of, touting being the outsider in this race. And even, you know, for somebody like Bannon, whose organization, Breitbart News, a conservative website, has been pretty critical of Republican leadership. So, you know, again, this is doubling down on what has gotten Trump here in the first place. Kellyanne Conway is somebody who's known pretty well through D.C. circles as a veteran Republican pollster and is somebody who, you know, will look at the crosstabs of a poll and try to shape a message in that way. But again, you know, you can move the pieces around as much as you want. This is still about the top of the ticket.
Well, Paul Manafort, we just want to stay with it a second. Because Paul Manafort made a real effort to tone down Donald Trump, whereas Trump's manager during the primaries, Corey Lewandowski, who had to step down, his motto was, let Trump be Trump. So you mentioned, you know, Stephen Bannon. Do you see the change as a return maybe to Trump's more off-the-cuff campaign?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just funny how many cooks you now have in the kitchen because, you know, you still have Manafort with campaign chairman title and chief strategist, Conway there as a messenger, and you have Bannon as now the person who is the CEO of the campaign. So, you know, it's a little bit like Survivor with this campaign, and you really haven't seen a campaign that has made these kinds of late changes, except back to 2004, you might remember, that after the John Kerry campaign didn't really respond to the Swift Boat ads. September 1st, John Kerry made a shakeup in his campaign, and of course, he went on to lose.
Yeah. Well, stay with Paul Manafort for a second. You were with us earlier this week talking about Paul Manafort's ties to the pro-Russia former president of Ukraine. To remind people, Manafort was openly the president's advisor in the past. Then this week, there was a report of a secret ledger showing off-the-book payments from the former Ukrainian president's political party to Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort denied getting any payments from the government, but not the political party. And then today, the AP is reporting that Manafort helped funnel more than $2 million from that pro-Russia political party to lobbying firms in D.C. So, look, this is still being investigated, but how much do you think this story of real ties that he's talked about being a campaign advisor to possible ties, how much has this led to this change?
You know, I think it's probably pretty coincidental. Honestly, Manafort's lobbying history for unsavory characters from the Middle East to Africa and Ukraine certainly was well known to Trump. I mean, he helped Trump lobby for his casinos. So, you know, I don't think any of this is new to Donald Trump, really, and was probably more coincidental than anything else, but could give the campaign a, certainly an excuse to move him aside.
Yeah. Trump's scheduled to get his first intelligence briefing at the FBI offices in New York today. As NPR has reported, he's expected to bring his friend, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. What more do we know about this meeting?
We also know that former General Flynn is going to be – Michael Flynn will be at this as well. And we know that it's held downtown at the FBI's offices because they have a secure room, which they wouldn't be able to have at someplace like Trump Tower. You know, this is standard protocol for both campaigns to both nominees to get intelligence briefings. And as President Obama has warned that both campaigns and candidates need to be careful with that information.
Yeah. Just a quick question. Donald Trump has been making Hillary Clinton's physical health a campaign point lately. By the way, she'll obviously have, you know, her own briefings with the FBI. But he's been questioning her physical stamina in a speech on Monday the last time. And social media memes have popped up trying to make this a real issue. There's a phony letter from a doctor floating around saying that she passes out and you know, doesn't have good health. What do we make of that?
Well, and Clinton strongly pushed back against this last night. Her campaign put out a statement saying that this was yet more evidence of Donald Trump pushing a, quote, deranged conspiracy. And they listed off some of the other conspiracy theories that Donald Trump has pushed in the past. And they released a statement from Hillary Clinton's doctor, who there's been a false report floating around that there were these leaked documents that Hillary Clinton didn't have good health. That doctor, who was actually signed on these false documents, said that those documents are false, that she says that gave Hillary Clinton a clean bill of health. The campaign also points to the fact that she sat for that Benghazi hearing back in October for 11 hours and was lauded for her stamina there during that campaign, during that questioning. So, you know, this is clearly an attempt by Donald Trump and his allies to be able to bring up Hillary Clinton's age. Donald Trump is about the same age, we should point out. So, you know, that's part of what's happening in this campaign.
Right. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, as we continue to follow the news in the presidential race, we're also monitoring House and Senate races around the country, which brings us to this week's district profile. In Nevada's 3rd congressional district, Republican Danny Tarkanian and Democrat Jackie Rosen are vying for an open seat left vacant by Republican Joe Heck, who is running for Senate. Carrie Kaufman is host and producer of KNPR's State of Nevada. She joins us from Las Vegas. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And describe this district for us. Where is it and how has it voted in recent elections?
It is kind of in the northern end of Las Vegas. It's a relatively new district. It came out in 2002, and the first representative was Republican. It went Democrat with Dina Titus in 2008, and then swung back to Joe Heck, who was a Republican in 2010, who has held that office since then.
And let's look at the candidates there right now. Republican Danny Tarkanian is a commercial real estate developer. He is described on his website as a conservative working for the people. Here's a radio spot he put out.
Hi, this is Danny Tarkanian, a constitutional conservative running for Congress. The NRA has rated me AQ, the highest possible rating. I'm the conservative supported by Nevada Right to Life. And conservative taxpayer groups say I'm the tax fighter Nevadans need in Congress.
Tell us about Tarkanian.
You know, Danny Tarkanian is the son of legendary UNLV basketball coach Jerry Tarkanian, who won a Final Four championship for Las Vegas back in 1990. Mm. Danny actually played for his dad in the 80s, and so he's been known around here for a long time. He has gotten into politics about a decade ago or so. He's run 4 times. He's lost all 4 times, all but the Senate campaign in 2008. He actually got to pass the primaries, but in the Senate campaign in 2008, he lost to Sharon Angle.
And what's he focusing on in this campaign? We heard him talk there about the NRA rating him very well.
You know, he's owning the conservative mantle. He is the conservative. He's a fiscal conservative. He doesn't particularly like spending. He doesn't like there have been taxes raised here. He's been come out against that. He's running under that conservative mantle.
And is he embracing Donald Trump?
He is. He has not enthusiastically come out and said, I love Donald Trump, but he has also said things that support him.
Well, let's talk about the other candidate in the race. This is Jackie Rosen, a Democrat who told Las Vegas Now that she became interested in running after she was able to see how much other members of Congress could help people in the district.
When I talk to people like Senator Reid or former Congresswoman Berkeley and what they're able to do for people right here in the district, the veterans, the seniors, the families, what they're able to do through their offices here really spoke to me as just a continuation of the kinds of things I've been doing in my personal life.
Tell us about Jackie Rosen.
Jackie Rosen is a total newcomer. She was the president of her temple, Temple Neir Tamid, here in Las Vegas. And Harry Reid met with her and asked her to run. And when she came out, the question on everybody's mind was, who's Jackie Rosen? And I met her once and asked her that the first time I met her, and she just laughed. She is surprisingly poised. She's very knowledgeable. She does her homework before she does interviews. And she won the primary to everybody's shock.
And is she tying herself to Hillary Clinton?
She is totally tying herself to Hillary Clinton, and she is running as the liberal's liberal.
Hmm. Is there a lot of outside money coming into the race?
You know what? At this point, there's not a whole lot of outside money coming into the race. There's Tarkanian has gotten about $800,000 against him in outside money. I haven't seen a whole lot of outside money coming to Jackie Rosen, and nothing has really heated up in terms of ads in this race from the candidates themselves.
And what are the polls saying at this point?
The polls, the last poll we have is from June, and it has Jackie Rosen up by 6 points. We don't get a lot of polling here in Nevada. Presumably, she's going to ride the coattails of Hillary Clinton. If Donald Trump does better than expected, Danny Tarkanian will do better than expected, too.
That's Carrie Kaufman, host and producer at KNPR's State of Nevada, talking with us about the 3rd district in Nevada, where Danny Tarkanian, a Republican, is running against Democrat Jackie Rosen to take over the seat, which is being left vacant by Republican Joe Heck, who is running for Senate. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We talked yesterday on the show about the soon-to-open Crossrail line in London, which will travel along a 73-mile stretch through 26 miles of tunnel under the city and is expected to open on budget and on time. Compare that to what's happening in New York City, where the opening of the 2nd Avenue subway line has been plagued with delays since it was first proposed in 1919, almost 100 years ago. Joining us now is Kate Hines, who covers transportation for WNYC. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Jeremy.
So let's start with the 2nd Avenue subway, because this has been going on for decades, but it was supposed to open later this year. Is it going to happen?
That is the $4.5 billion question. The MTA is still sticking by its estimates that the system will open in December. However, every month at MTA board meetings, they have an independent engineer come in and evaluate the construction progress. And every month for the past several months, the estimates have been getting more and more dire, with the engineer saying things like, well, you're going to really have to step up construction. So it sounded fairly dire last month, like the MTA would have to devote dozens, hundreds, if not, you know, more workers to put on the job. But, you know, the MTA says it's going to be in place in December, but we'll see.
And how unusual is this for a new subway line, an entire line, to open in New York?
Oh, my gosh. This is the first construction of a new subway line in many, many decades in New York City.
And what's the reason for that? Is it just cost, that people want to do it, but it's just too expensive?
Yeah. As you know, the 2nd Avenue subway has been talked about since before the Great Depression, which is part of the reason it got derailed in the first place. And it's been resurrected over the decades. Part of the problem with the 2nd Avenue subway is that, you know, the city announced that it was going to construct it, and then it tore down the elevated lines on 2nd and 3rd Avenue, you know, in the 40s and the 50s, to make way for the subway, which didn't get built, which meant the existing subway line on the east side of Manhattan just got incredibly congested. Now people are saying, you know, we have this little stub of a line that's only going to go from 63rd to 96th. We really need the whole line built out. And the MTA is saying, look, you know, now we're building a subway system where things already exist. We have to move utilities. You know, we have a lot more regulations right in place than when the subway system was built over 100 years ago.
So how much of a difference will it make to have even that little sliver? Because there are a lot of people who live in that part of Manhattan.
There are a lot of people who live in that part of Manhattan. The subway line that serves the east side of Manhattan now, the Lexington Avenue line, is the most crowded transit line in the entire country. It serves something like 1.3 million riders a day. The MTA hopes that the 2nd Avenue subway will serve about 200,000 daily riders. But, you know, there's some doubt being cast upon those estimates. And part of the problem is, even when the line opens in December, if it opens in December, it will have headways of 8 minutes, meaning people have to wait 8 minutes between trains. And part of that has to do with the way the system is constructed in terms of interlockings and switches. But part of that has to do with the MTA just doesn't have the subway car rolling stock that it needs to really put all of these trains in service.
All right, let's talk about the other big story going on with the MTA right now, which is that they're going to have to close down a tunnel, a very important tunnel, on the L train, which takes people from Manhattan to Brooklyn and back, for a long period of time to repair damage from Hurricane Sandy.
Right. This is called the Canarsie Tube. It takes the L train under the East River between Brooklyn and Manhattan. And like many other tunnels that go under the rivers in New York City, it got flooded during Sandy, which meant that millions and millions of gallons of East River water inundated the system. even though it drained out and the system was dried out, there were corrosive salts left behind that got into the electrical systems and into the concrete. And now you have the concrete bench wall is crumbling. There are increasing signal failures. And the MTA says, look, the only way we can really get in there and to replace it and to fix it is to take the tunnel basically down to the studs and rebuild it from the inside out.
But what does that mean for the riders during that period of time?
It means 18 months of no L train service between Brooklyn and Manhattan, none at all. But, you know, it's not going to take place until the beginning of 2019. So the city and the state and the MTA all have to work pretty closely on what the alternatives are going to be to get these people around.
Well, and because it doesn't have to happen until 2019, and it's now been a number of years since Hurricane Sandy, so presumably they've known that they were going to have to do something like this for a little while. And I'm sure that the people at the MTA, if they hear me say this, will say he's crazy. But was there ever a talk about just building a second tunnel to be open while this tunnel is under construction? Can they do that in a number of years?
They can't do it by the time the Canarsie tunnel crumbles, essentially. You know, that was something that was on the table and talked about. It's financially not feasible, and the environmental impact statement and the environmental regulation process basically makes it a non-starter.
Kate, after talking to you and after our conversation yesterday with a representative from the Tube in London talking about this big Crossrail project that they're building, it sounds to me, and you tell me if I'm wrong, like in London, they are planning for the future, and in New York, they're trying to keep up with the past.
That's pretty true. It's pretty hard to build new subway lines here in New York City because every time someone gets an idea and says, gosh, it would be great to have this line, there's some financial downturn. And part of the problem is it's so hugely expensive to construct underground infrastructure here in the city. And a couple of people have looked at this and wondered why this is. And, you know, some people have floated the idea that part of it is because so much is happening at once. At the same time the MTA is building the Second Avenue subway system, the Port Authority is trying to build a new PATH train terminal at the World Trade Center. People are starting to bid out the Gateway Tunnel, which is the rail tunnel that goes under the Hudson River that Amtrak owns. So there's a lot of competing infrastructure happening. Oh, the MTA is also building East Side Access, which brings rail from Long Island Railroad into Grand Central Terminal. So these huge things are already happening, which kind of means your labor pool is shorter and costs are going up.
And yet there is a record number of people riding the MTA right now.
Yeah, it's almost 6 million daily riders on the subway system, you know, on basically what is the same subway system that was in place in the 70s and 80s when about 4 million people rode it every day.
That's Kate Hines, who covers transportation for WNYC in New York City. Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, up above the subway, the streets of New York are greener after a million trees were planted across the city in the last few years. In addition to providing shade, urban trees also remove pollution from the air. And a recent Forest Service study estimated the air cleaning effect of trees in New York City saves about 8 lives a year. How about that? Phoenix has a goal of covering a quarter of the city with a tree canopy by 2030. And in Ohio, researchers are beginning to take a closer look at how much stress urban trees can handle. Matt Richman from Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream reports.
This has got to be the strangest way to make a living that I've ever known.
Davy Tree Research Farm is surrounded by cornfields and woods on a normally quiet stretch of Route 303 in Shalersville, Ohio. Once every 3 years, researchers including Jason Grabowski from Rutgers University and volunteers from local tree trimming companies come here to bend, break, cut back, and measure the strength of trees, all in the name of science. In one patch of the farm, a volunteer saws through tree roots. The idea is to find out how wind exposure affects their growth. In another grove, a tool called an air knife exposes roots, using only forced air that's traveling at 2 times the speed of sound. It allows researchers to study the roots without damaging them.
Taking a third again because of that one dead one.
There's also some quiet observation going on. Tom Smiley is from the Bartlett Tree Research Laboratory in North Carolina. He's here to examine how far back the roots can be cut before the tree becomes unstable.
What we found is if you're doing a linear cut for a water line or a sidewalk or a sewer line, that you should measure the trunk diameter and multiply that by 3, and that's as close as you'd want to get.
All this is important information. When gas lines or water lines are installed or replaced, there's likely to be tree roots in the way. Wes Coker is with the International Society of Arboriculture, which was founded in 1924.
Over the last, let's say 25, 30 years, there's been a lot more emphasis on science, a lot more emphasis on research and data collection.
Coker does educational outreach with arborists and says it takes a lot of work to change age-old practices. Another example of how hard it is to change techniques, says Coker, comes right at the start of a tree's life.
In the forest, a seed drops on the ground and the tree starts its life almost in the top inch of the soil. Whereas in the city, they come from a nursery, the tree's been repotted or replanted numerous times, and every time it gets potted deeper and deeper and deeper, and then when we finally put it in the city, sometimes they can be a foot deep.
That's why trees in the city look like a telephone pole stuck in the ground, while trees in the forest have a natural wide base of partially exposed roots. Guy Mayer runs a tree trimming business in North Carolina. He's here to test out different tree trimming techniques. The goal is to limit the decay that gets into a tree after it's trimmed and to prune trees in a way that encourages more compact regrowth. Mayer says they have a pretty good idea of how the tree will regrow because they've seen it on the job.
Out here, this gives us an opportunity to record data in a more systematic fashion and be able to publish it, and so that makes it more verifiable and easier for people to trust and follow.
Researchers will return to universities and research centers and tree trimming companies in New Jersey and North Carolina and Mexico and pore over the data they've collected. They plan to be back in Ohio again in 2019 to see how the trees are responding. For Here and Now, I'm Matt Richmond.
Acetaminophen, Tylenol, has long been considered one of the safest pain relievers for pregnant women. But a new study out this week in the medical journal JAMA Pediatrics finds a link between acetaminophen used during pregnancy and later behavioral problems in children. Sharon Begley is a senior science writer at STAT, the health and medicine publication, and our weekly partner. So, Sharon, this study's, of course, a little scary. Take us through. We know women were first asked when they were pregnant if they were taking the painkiller, then 7 years later asked about their kids. Pretty extensive. But tell us more about what researchers found.
That's right, Robin. It was indeed a very extensive study. More than 7,000 women were in it. And that's the kind of number that you like to see when you're asking, is this credible? Is this believable? The research was done in England. And this is a quite famous group of women. In other words, the study was actually begun in the 1990s. And these women and their children have been followed now for many, many years. So all of that gives it some credibility. And yes, as you said, the bottom line finding is that women who reported taking acetaminophen during their pregnancy, either early at 18 weeks and earlier or 32 weeks and a few months before that, their children, when the kids were 7, had a higher incidence of various behavioral conduct problems, including emotional symptoms, hyperactivity, problems relating to other children. And the increased risk was as high as 46%, which is, a number you pay attention to.
Right. But is it clear that that's causal and not coincidental? As you write, it could have been that pregnant women having a low consumption of fish is the reason that the children have had this behavior, because there's been studies showing that. Is it clear that it's the Tylenol?
In fact, it was this very study, the same group of participants in whom the connection between healthy fish eating during pregnancy and kids' outcome was shown. So whenever we cover medical science studies like this, we always try to dig into the methodology. How did the researchers do what they did? And what's the basis for what they're reporting? So as you said, this is an observational study. Basically, you just have a bunch of women and say, live your lives, and then tell us, what you did, and we're going to make some measurements. So one concern is that women who chose to take Tylenol during their pregnancy were somehow different from women who did not. Just a couple things to throw out there. As you said, fish consumption, but also education level, IQ. And both of those are related to the kids' subsequent behavioral adjustment, conduct problems, etc. And that was not studied. So the connection that they saw, the 46% elevated risk of behavioral problems, could have been due to something other than the Tylenol. Yeah. And that's always the concern in a study like this.
The acetaminophen. Well, so meantime, there have been other studies over the years that have shown links, just links, between acetaminophen use in pregnancy and ADHD-like behaviors in kids later in life. So what should pregnant women do?
So that's really the telling question, Robin. And I asked the chief scientist that very question, and she said, still take it. And the main reason is that fever and infection when you are pregnant can be very risky for the fetus, much more risky than any connection anyone has found to acetaminophen.
If you're taking it casually, you don't really need it, maybe not. Sharon Begley, senior science writer with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, will link you to this research at herenow.org. Sharon, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Chris Doritas is a DJ at KCRW. He's with us from Santa Monica. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. And let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is the British artist Jones with Melt.
Whatever happens, you know we're gonna repair. No matter what happens, you know we got something rare. Started with nothing, grew into something. We got the heat to last a lifetime if it's the right time. Trust in me, take it from someone who's at a tough run. Oh, no matter what happens, no matter what happens, we got the heat.
I like that, and I see that it has been described as a chill wave haze.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, we're in radio, right? So we don't have to describe stuff. We can just play
just play it, right, exactly. But tell us what you like about this one.
Well, I came across this thing on SoundCloud, and it just jumped out as such a feel-good, summery, breezy tune. And I looked into her. She's this stunning young singer from the UK. Her name's Sherry Jones Mattis. She just goes by Jones. And this is like the third single, I think, in what was to be an album that is finally coming out in October 7th. She's got an album coming out. It's called New Skin. And I've heard the album. This is my favorite track from the album. I highly recommend people search this thing out because it's just a good, summery, breezy tune.
Well, let's get to another one that you wanted us to hear. This is Maggie Rogers with Alaska. Now, one thing people may know about Maggie Rogers is she took part in a masterclass taught by Pharrell Williams at NYU.
Yeah, he was doing this masterclass at NYU's Clive Davis Institute. This was back in February. He was just critiquing students' work. He was really encouraging and, you know, trying to be constructive. But when he heard this song from one of the students in the class, Maggie Rogers, he slowly turned to her with his mouth hanging open. And the moment was caught on video and it went online. And then by June, it was getting picked up all across the internet. The song has now garnered over 11 million plays online. She's only got this one song out.
Wow. And what should we know about her?
Well, we should know that there's more to come. This is such an incredible, like, footprint with just one song out there. She's working on an EP that's coming at some point, but she's taking her time because this was sort of a, you know, cart before the horse thing. She wasn't expecting this kind of attention.
All right, the next one you brought us is by Cleopold. This is Not Coming Down.
different place and time. Over and under, I stop and start, never the finish line. I'm not coming down. No, I'm not coming down. I'm not coming down. No, I'm not coming down. I'm not coming down.
Now this could be a big summer hit. I can feel it.
Right? Yeah, this is, he had a song called Down in Flames, which is still getting a lot of play here at KCRW. This song comes from an EP. It's actually his debut release, you know, other than these singles. And it comes from a label that was started by Chet Faker, and it's his first signing to the label, Cleopold. The album, Altitude and Oxygen, is like four tracks, and this track is on it, and it's called Not Coming Down. Yeah, I think it could be a big thing. He's so unassuming, too. He's a really funny guy. You wouldn't know that he was an artist if you walked in the room. He comes from Australia, but he's based here in Los Angeles now.
And that song that you mentioned, Down in Flames, actually was on a previous DJ session that we had with Aaron Bird from KCRW. So obviously, Cleopold making the rounds at KCRW. You guys are
big
fans.
We love him. Yeah, we're big fans.
All right, the next one is the French artist Fakir, who has this song with Ray Morris. It's called Silver. There's almost, if I could just give her an Icelandic accent, there's a tiny bit of Björk in my mind here as I'm listening to her.
You're absolutely correct. She's a singer-songwriter from England. Her name is Rachel Ann Morris. She goes by Ray. And she's working with Fakir. This is a French producer and composer who I'm completely smitten with. He's got a whole album of tracks. She's on one of them. And the album's just out. It's called Animal. It's on Ninja Tune, which is a really respected label. And he's just 24 years old. He's doing very well in France, but he's not very well known here in the U.S. yet. We're playing him a lot, though.
All right. Well, we have time for one more. And on this one, Chris, we cannot say the name of the group on the air in its entirety. Thank you for giving us that challenge. It's the group is called Nice As Something. This is Guns. Is there a political message there?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's good timing because the dialogue in the public consciousness is at a point where I think this is a good song to be heard.
Well, tell us more about this group, Nice As Bleep.
Yeah, Nice As Fire Truck, can we say that?
We could say that, probably, yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's a super group. You know, it's Jenny Lewis. It's a new project from her, and it features Erica Forster from Au Revoir Simone, Tennessee Thomas from The Like. Tennessee is Pete Thomas's daughter, you know, Pete Thomas from Elvis Costello's band. He's the drummer. And they've done this thing. It's a whole album of material, but I really like this particular song just because of the way it resonates with what's going on in the world right now.
But I almost feel like if you give your band that name, you are asking radio DJs not to play you because they would have to say who you are, and they can't say those words on the air.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing different things here at KCRW. We've been saying NAF, N-A-F. It is a challenge, yeah.
Well, Chris Doritis, DJ at KCRW, thank you so much for bringing these songs to our attention.
Jeremy, it's always good to talk to you.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. And you can find us on Apple Music as well or at hereandnow.org.
Social media is spitting mad over a video that went viral this week. It shows a bear who seemed to have been lured to a garbage can being hit by American Josh Bomar with a spear attached to a GoPro camera. The video appears to show Josh Bomar laughing afterwards with friends.
Can you believe this? Oh my gosh.
He says, I smoked him. Animal rights activists and even some hunters are outraged. The bear was mortally wounded and left to struggle before dying. Shades of Cecil the Lion. And a cautionary tale about posting on social media. What else is happening in that often bruising world? Kate Somers-Dawes is deputy managing editor at Mashable. She joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Robin.
And let's look at the Olympics because, boy, social media has been all over the Olympics, you know, mostly cheering on competitors, but also, boy, the boos from the sidelines have been amazing. American gymnast Gabby Douglas, who did phenomenally well in London in 2012, came back. She was part of the team gold at this Olympics, but didn't qualify for the individual all-around finals, got seventh on the unevens, where she struggled a bit. Let's listen.
Oh, my goodness.
You can see there just... almost didn't make it over that bar, but what a fight she gave to stay on the bars.
Okay, so, you know, didn't have a good day on the uneven bars, but how did social media respond?
So she was called disrespectful and, quote, disgusting for standing at attention instead of saluting the flag on the podium during the team win last week. You know, her patriotism was questioned, which is, you know, sort of unusual for somebody who's competed so strongly for the U.S. and, you know, since she's a little kid and since 2012, certainly. There's also sort of some absurdity to the comments. Users made negative remarks about her hair, insinuating that it didn't look good enough or it didn't look done enough while she was competing. And that's a comment that had, you know, come in the 2012 Olympics, too, which is also sort of a strange way to talk about an athlete.
Yeah, and the thing about social media is that it gets repeated. It gets Xeroxed, if you will. It gets copied. And so when she's meeting the media afterwards, they're asking her about the social media, you know, and not asking her about her events. And the Washington Post reports that she found a quiet place to just cry. And then that brought another response. The Ghostbusters actress Leslie Jones started a hashtag for Gabby, hashtag Love for Gabby USA. Tell us about Leslie Jones, what happened to her, and then what happened with this hashtag.
That's right. Sure. Leslie Jones. So she's also an outspoken Olympics fan of her own, you know, in her own right. But she is an actress from Ghostbusters. She's a star on Saturday Night Live. She was briefly chased off of Twitter in July by Twitter trolls herself who attacked her for appearing in Ghostbusters. It seemed to be a group of people who didn't believe or think that that women should be
allowed, African-American women, because she's another black woman.
That's right, another black woman, and there was definitely a outright racist tenor to some of these critiques. And she came back to the service in July and got a lot of attention herself in August for offering exuberant, hilarious Olympics commentary on Twitter.
Her tweets have been so successful. The Olympics actually brought her there. I know she's been sending out some audio. Most of the stuff is complete expletive. We can't play it. But do you have one there?
Sure. Here's a great tweet from Leslie Jones.
USA, we slay all day, and we don't play, and we here to stay. USA.
And what was the response to her supportive hashtag for Gabby, hashtag Love for Gabby USA?
Yes, exactly. So she seems to have started this hashtag Love for Gabby USA. That tweet had 6.5 thousand retweets. And there were hundreds of tweeted replies saying that Douglas had made the USA proud, not to listen to the bullies, that no one can take away her achievements. So, you know, as quickly as Twitter users can jump to tear someone down, I think there's an equal, if not larger, group of people who are ready to build someone back up. And they showed that in that response.
And just briefly, Kate, the images of young people reacting to American swimmer Simone Manuel's gold medal in the 100-meter freestyle last week, the first African-American to win an individual swimming event. Talk about just a couple of the images online.
That's right. She made history last week in the sport of swimming. And an incredibly popular tweet that was posted after she won was actually tweeted by gymnastic champion Simone Biles, who tweeted an image of herself with Simone Manuel that just simply said Simone times two. That inspired many people online. It had 32,000 retweets and 91,000 likes as of today, with just a litany of enthusiastic responses from people who said that they cried watching both of them compete. LeBron James even posted an image of the pair of Simones on Instagram, and his caption was, "Congrats, young queens, truly inspiring for so many, especially young black girls. My daughter was watching with me." And there were many parents, too, who posted images of their young daughters at the pool. One user posted an image of her daughter in front of Manuel on the television, and the little girl had her hand raised up in the air, and the caption said, "I got next."
That is great. Kate Summers-Dawes, Deputy Managing Editor at Mashable, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin. Glad to be here.
And we've got links to some of the stories we talked about, including that bear spearing up in Canada. But we'll make sure we get some of those pictures of those little girls saying, "I'm next." And that's at herenow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.